You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Today is Wednesday, February 25th, 2026. My guests today are Phil Graham and Don Boudreau to discuss their new book, The Triumph of Economic Freedom. Phil Graham, prior to serving as a congressman, senator, and presidential candidate, was an economics professor at Texas A&M. Don Boudreau is my colleague here at GMU. He has served as the chair of the Department of Economics, and before that, president of the Foundation for Economic Education, as well as a professor of law and economics at Clemson University. Don and Phil, thank you for being here with me today. I really enjoyed your new book. And in fact, I consider it one of the really great and important popular books in economics to be published in many years. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for that. That's a very nice compliment. And we appreciate it.
So I don't have the questions directed at either one of you. Just sort of jump in and you can both fill in for one another. I'm sure you're used to this by now. But I was wondering if just for the audience, you could summarize the seven myths that the book tackles and why tackling those are so important for your general economic understanding and public policy.
Well, why don't I start by simply noting that Thomas Jefferson said good men with the same facts are prone to disagree. But in academics and in government and in business, I have almost invariably found that when people fundamentally disagree, that they have very different perceptions about how the world works. And specifically, there are seven areas where their views are, if they have diametrically opposed opinions on policy issues of the day, invariably, on those seven issues, they have very different views. How we view the world is based on our experience and based on our knowledge. And the basic thesis of the book is that the best way we have of affecting people's opinion is to basically address what we consider and set out to prove or the seven great myths of American capitalism. Don, you want to go over the myths?
Well, yeah. So I think this is an order that we have it in the book. The book has seven core chapters in addition to an introduction and a conclusion. And the first myth is what we call the Genesis myth. And this is the one chapter that talks about economic history not limited to the United States. We look at the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain, and as well as the industrialization later in the U.S. And so that's the first myth, the Genesis myth. The second myth is the progressive era regulation myth, you know, this notion that particularly after the U.S. Civil War, the American economy grew monopolized and food became poisonous and workplaces became lethal, and it took noble Congress people and bureaucrats to rush to the rescue in order to save Americans from this ruination. The third myth is the myth of the Great Depression, the notion that the Great Depression represented a failure of capitalism and that the rescue from the Great Depression was achieved by government intervention on a scale we'd never seen before, namely the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. The fourth fallacy that we address is one that's very relevant today, probably the single most, well, one of the most relevant ones today, and that is the myth of the hollowing out, allegedly, of the American economy. This notion that especially over the past 50 years, since the mid-1970s, the U.S. economy, especially because of more open trade and increasing globalization, that America's middle class has been hollowed out, destroyed, pushed into the lower ranks. We don't produce anything anymore. Our manufacturing is on the ropes. And that leads to the myth, which we address in, I can't remember offhand whether it's chapter 6 or 7 in the book, the myth of inequality in America. The notion that, especially since the end of the war and the increasing with alleged hollowing out, that economic inequality in America has accelerated. So this is a myth that Phil and Bob Eaglin and John Early addressed in even more detail in their wonderful 2022 book, The Myth of American Inequality. But we have a chapter in our book on that with some new material and some updating. And the final myth that we address is the myth of poverty in America. The notion that there are a number of Americans who are just mired in poverty. There's something essential about the American economy that keeps people poverty stricken, and that the war on poverty has been a failure when measured by the ability of Americans to earn or take in annually enough income to raise them above some reasonably defined poverty level. So I think I hit all the 7.
No, you missed one. You missed the financial crisis.
It was caused
by deregulation.
Yes, that's right.
One of the things that's fascinating, I think, about the book is that it's very similar to Hans Reisling's book, Factfulness, as opposed to, say, Thomas Sowell's Conflict of Visions. That's not really, the Conflict of Visions isn't really, it's in the background, but it's not the focus. It's getting the facts right, which is a kind of a fascinating thing, because historians oftentimes are innumerate in economics. There's this book out, which right now by Sven Beckert, A Global History of Capitalism. And, you know, he's the person in charge of the Center for the Study of Capitalism at Harvard. And his idea about what went on with economic growth and development and the sources of it and how you can attribute this to slavery or that to, you know, colonialism or whatever is just amazing, you know. But what you guys do
amazingly
in the book,
wrong,
is,
I assume.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, like by factors in terms of, you know, what we know in economics. And one of the things is like you guys just really hammer home like the facts about stuff, right? Starting with the Industrial Revolution, right? Which is just, you know, what happened to the average person because the hockey stick went like this, not what happened to the wealthiest people, but what happened to the lives or life's prospects of the average person. And so one of the things I kept on thinking about when I was reading your book, and I understand I'm biased, but I kept on thinking, you know, why is there this persistence of the myths? It's not like these are new myths. These are deep myths, as you point out, right? Dickens has a view about what's going on in the Industrial Revolution that goes all the way back. Carlyle, all these people, right? They had these kind of ideas. And I was wondering if you had any clue as you were going through it and reading all these primary sources about why you think the mythologies persist, because the evidence is not hidden and the reasoning isn't esoteric, right? It's that in order for them to believe what they believe, they actually have to hold theories that are often in conflict with just basic, you know, understanding of how human beings behave. And then the second thing is that the facts don't line up. They're more sensationalized. I was just wondering, as you were going through this, you know, did you get a good sense of persistence of the mythologies?
First of all, I think that it's important to note that we set the book up where we first give sort of a very brief summary of the period that's undisputed. And then we present what we call the myth, and we try to present it in the strongest form, the arguments from historians, economists, in the popular literature, and what facts they present. And in fact, I think we had 14 people read the manuscript, and 9 of the 14 complained that it looked like we wrote the myth to try to convince people that the myth was true and that we needed to change it. And wisely, I think, we didn't change it. We're not trying to set up a straw man and knock it down. But I think basically that you may have read Hammond's book on the history of banking in America. He's an economist at University of Chicago in the 1930s. And I remember reading that book, and he begins the book by saying that you need to understand before you start this book that everything you know about banking history in America is wrong. And by the time you finish reading the book, you find out that that's exactly true. And in that case, the people that were writing about banking in the newspaper didn't know anything about banking. And so the sort of contemporary observations end up being written in the history books, and for the Industrial Revolution being a perfect example, from Arnold Toynbee to writers of fiction in the era, the view is that this is a terrible thing going on. And in the case of the Industrial Revolution, it was a wave of creative destruction. The creation was more production of goods and services than had ever existed. And the division between British statistics and British literature is astonishing. But basically, the facts are that, as Marx clearly recognized, that the Industrial Revolution, Marx said, had unleashed more productive forces than all other periods in history combined, and did it in 100 years. But it piteously destroyed the existing order and took man from the benign supervision of his superiors and put him in a market that was driven by self-interest and money. Now, we now know that market's called economic freedom. But Marx thought it meant this opening of exploitation, and he goes off on a tangent about all the value ought to go to workers, and it ended up impoverishing and enslaving half the world. So historians take conventional wisdom and don't go and look at the facts. And the facts in the Industrial Revolution is no people who've ever breathed the breath of life on the planet ever saw their well-being. And it was a workers' revolution. Their well-being grow and improve more than in the 100 years of the Industrial Revolution. And we prove it.
Let me add to that. I mean, this is something that Phil had in earlier writings, and we have it in this one too. It's not a hot take, but it's important to note that, and it's especially evident in the Industrial Revolution, when everyone's in poverty, when the vast majority of people are in poverty, when they've been in poverty for generations, you don't notice it. It just seems that's the normal state of the world. And ironically, when economic growth began to lift ordinary people well above subsistence, then more and more it stood out. The people who were still closer to subsistence stood out as being poor. And that's when the leisure class would bemoan they blamed capitalism. And capitalism was, it is ironic, was to blame in the following way. Capitalism, by making more ordinary people rich, made more visible the handful who still remained to be lifted out of poverty. But that led mistakenly to a condemnation of capitalism and the Industrial Revolution, where, of course, it should have done the opposite. It should have led people to universally praise the system that is raising people out of the mire.
Yeah, prior to the Industrial Revolution, nobody thought that it would ever be possible that one out of every five children didn't die before they were 5 years old. The idea of banishing poverty was unthinkable. People for 1,000 years lived the way their grandparents had lived. And we've got hard data to show that. And then suddenly, as you call it, the hockey stick, suddenly in a 100-year period, world GDP, which had been totally flat, turned up and almost has gone straight up in the last 150 years, and it's never stopped.
Let me just add one more thing. Given that we are at this time of year, we're a few days away from celebrating the 250th anniversary of the publication of The Wealth of Nations. And I love the full title of that book, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. So Adam Smith is writing this book at a time when the early part of the Industrial Revolution has begun to lift people out of poverty. But it's still the case. He's writing in an era when most people were very poor by our standards. And so he's inquiring into the causes of wealth, which is the right thing to inquire into. You don't inquire into the causes of poverty. Poverty has no causes. It's the default mode of humanity. 100 years later, when Phil mentioned 100 years, I thought of this. Just over 100 years later, Alfred Marshall writes his great book, The Principles of Economics. And on page 2 of The Principles of Economics, Marshall says something like, the one purpose of economics is to study, and I quote, the causes of poverty. In that 100 years between 1776, when The Wealth of Nations was published, and 1890, when The Principles of Economics was first published, Great Britain and the English-speaking world had become so rich that one of the greatest economists in the world just took for granted that wealth was the norm and poverty was the exception. That says a lot about how powerful capitalism was.
I always appreciate you pointing that out, Don. This is the old P.T. Bauer point, as you know, that no cause of poverty. Poverty is the natural state of mankind. I mean, there is some hope in this story because I held up the Beckert book, but at the same time, this last fall, we celebrated Joel Mulcair. He was a great historian of the Industrial Revolution with the Nobel Prize. So, you know, there is a lot of hope that maybe we'll get the facts right about this. And in particular, this point about the benefits that accrued to the ordinary individual. I mean, you highlight the work of Emma Griffin in that regard in your chapter, and she's really good at documenting that aspect of it through diaries and stuff. And so not only the formal data, but then any kind of accounts of personal lives that people had. And as Phil said, having a child live to adulthood, you know. And you know, one of the things that I really loved about that chapter too was your discussion of Queen Anne. Maybe you can just mention that real quick to people so that can, this is the elite of the elite. And this woman had this horrible life.
I know Phil wants to say something, but Queen Anne of England, who died at the age of 49 in 1714, she was lucky by one standard. A lot of women died after giving birth to children. She got pregnant, we know, 17 times. Most of her children were stillborn, a handful died in infancy, a couple made it a little bit longer. She had one child make it past infancy, Prince William, who died at the age of 10 or 11. When Queen Anne died, as Queen of England, just over 300 years ago, she lost everyone. She had to bury every one of her children. It's astonishing. Perhaps the greatest single achievement of capitalism is that it makes it unusual for parents to bury a child. I can't think of a worse fate than to have to bury a child. And I can't think of a better achievement than saving parents from that, what was almost a certain event prior to the Industrial Age.
Yeah, I was going to make the point that prior to the Industrial Revolution, children worked everywhere. And after the Industrial Revolution had set in, wages started to rise, people started to live longer, literacy exploded. More and more people were able to put their children in school and take them out of the factory or off the farm. And yet, the critics of capitalism blame capitalism for child labor when capitalism actually created the base of productivity that allowed us to remove that scourge of the earth. Secondly, I just wanted to point out, and that's a perfect example, there's a myth from the ancient Greeks. And the myth is a shepherd is tending his flocks, and he hears this screaming in this gorge that's got all kinds of briars in it. And he goes over, and there's this girl in this gorge, beautiful girl. And so he manages to get her out. And when she gets out, she's so radiant that he immediately figures out she's a goddess. And so she says to him, I'm going to grant you wishes. What do you want? And he's afraid that he's going to come across as having hubris. And so he says, well, I'd like to be prosperous, and I'd like to have a long life, and I'd like to have a son that grew up to adulthood. Okay, so you've got this goddess who's going to grant you anything in the world you want. And what one of the three things you want is to have a child that lives to adulthood. Now, that tells you something.
You know, also, again, you guys do such a great job of telling the stories and weaving stories in with the facts and amazing. So I, you know, again, in that part of the chapter, one of the things that's really fascinating is the pointing out that in the Christmas Carol, you know, you're visited upon by poverty and ignorance, as if somehow prior to the Industrial Revolution, poverty and ignorance didn't exist, right? It was like, that was, again, your point, Don, that was like the natural state of people.
Yeah, and I think, Peter, prior to, this was, I think, December of 1849 that the book was published, one of the most successful books in history.
Oh, 43, and, I think.
40, oh, yeah, December of 1843. And Charles Dickens could not conceive, based on the world he had lived in, that poverty could ever be dealt with in any other way other than charity. But what he didn't see is that at the very moment that he was pulling back, having the Christmas future pull back his gown and show the ignorance and want the two children that their neglect was going to destroy the world, he could not conceive that at that very moment, production was exploding in Britain that would eliminate both those problems, at least in the Western world. And he couldn't conceive it because all we know is what has happened before us. It's seeing the future.
Yeah, I know.
You got to have vision better than mankind to do that.
So, all right. So I've been talking to you a lot about the Industrial Revolution, but you have several other really important episodes in history. And I was just wondering, as you were doing your research, were there examples where you might have had some of the myths that were disabused because of the research you were doing? So, for example, you know, it's a very standard view. You know, my dad was a veteran in World War II. You know, he believed the government got us out of the Great Depression, basically, right? And so trying to talk to him, he didn't so much care about what caused the Great Depression. It was cared about what got us out of the Great Depression. You guys document using the work of Higgs and others to show that, you know, narrative isn't right. The deregulation caused the Great Recession kind of argument. The mythologies and the progressive era, you know, what were the ones that most maybe sort of surprised you yourselves as you were thinking through these?
Let me answer it in the following way. The two chapters that I learned most from writing, that I learned most about, were writing the chapter on the Great Depression and writing the chapter on the financial crisis. I knew a little bit about both, but my knowledge of both was not, I couldn't, without having done further research, help to write those chapters. So I learned a lot. I was about the financial crisis. I knew this in the abstract because I'd heard it, but I didn't know the details. I was shocked at the extent to which government leading up to 2007, you know, so from the 1990s, and especially in the very early years of the 21st century, I was shocked at the degree to which government manipulated banks, manipulated Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to extend mortgages to people who really couldn't afford the mortgages, all in a quest to drive up the numbers of home ownership. So that's probably the thing I learned most about, learning about the details of how the Fed operated in the 1920s, from the crash of 1920-21, which we've forgotten now because it didn't last very long, through 1929 when the famous crash happened. That was also something I learned a lot about. I didn't realize that the Fed was actually a lot more decentralized according to its original plan from 1914 through 1923 around than it has since become. So those are some things I learned.
I learned something in every chapter. And I give Don credit for the point you made about the Depression. And let me say, my mama went to her grave believing that Franklin Roosevelt got us out of the Depression. But we show, I think, very convincingly, using data that is readily available from League of Nations documentation, which I've never seen a historian use, and which is almost not used in economic history. There is comprehensive data from the League of Nations that compares the recovery of developed countries.
From the Great Depression, yeah.
Yeah, and that, in terms of wages, employment, economic growth, and America consistently underperformed the rest of the world. And Don really led us to add the section on how the war, obviously, when you put 14 million men in uniform and become the arsenal of democracy, you tend to take people out of the unemployment line. But by what we call prosperity, when you look at ability to consume goods and services, when you look at the value of investments and retirement, the Depression really didn't end until the 1950s. And one of the great sections that we did that I was totally unaware of was how economists like Paul Samuelson were so convinced that when the war ended, we were going right back into the Depression because of the under-consumptionist theory, that there was this huge demand for this massive government program as the war started to wind down. And fortunately, none of it happened. And in fact, when the very conditions that had created and sustained and worsened the Depression were lifted, the economy recovered and equity values went back to where they were in 1929, but it didn't happen until Eisenhower was president. So that's was a real eye-opener to me. But I learned something in every chapter.
Well, I'm sure your readers are going to learn a ton in each chapter. You know, I mean, even I'll get to this, but the chapter on whether or not trade hollows out, you know, jobs and stuff like that is like critically valuable for today and the conversation and everything. So, but I wanted to push you a little bit on something. And, you know, I might be making this up, so push back, which is that when I was a kid and I decided I really got into economics, one of the most important books for me was Milton Friedman and Rose Friedman's Free to Choose. That book appeared when I was a freshman in college, and I got really, you know, totally excited about what it had to do. And I, to this day, I'm still just totally impressed with the book. And I love the chapters, The Power of the Market and the Tyranny of Controls. But one of the chapters I really, really like is the one on who protects the consumer, in which he talks about how market forces do a better job than regulators at protecting consumers. I think that, but what Friedman does in there is he basically says, you know, Friedman had a way with words that very few people do. And he said, listen, Adam Smith had this invisible hand. And in the invisible hand, the pursuit of self-interest generates outcomes that serve the public interest. But in politics, the invisible hand works the opposite way. The pursuit of public interest results in outcomes that generate only the benefits to the private interest, right? So, you know, so that makes you start thinking about all these ideas. What's interesting to me in your book, in your blowing up of the mythologies, I don't think that you relied all that much on public choice explanations as much as just getting the facts wrong about the issue. In the antitrust policy, you know, discussions, obviously you have it there because the Sherman Antitrust Act, you know, who's behind it, all these things like that. And, you know, public choice in many ways is all about who benefits at whose expense. And that's part of the persistence issue, who benefits at whose expense. But I was just wondering if you agree with that, you know, assessment of the book, that you're more focused on the issues having to do with the achievement, the mythologies being there because we get the facts wrong.
Yeah, we took, you mentioned the exception, with the exception of the Sherman Act part, we basically took the stated purposes of the regulators at face value. So, okay, then you want to protect consumers from, you know, eating rotten meat, and you want to protect workers from, you know, being chewed up in factory machines. What were the results of those regulatory interventions? And we don't dispute the public choice explanations. We just don't deal with them as much as maybe we would have if we had written a multi-volume work.
Yeah. Also, I'd add that one of the things I think we wisely did was we don't try to attribute motives for bad policy. What we try to do is simply point out that bad policy produces bad results, not sometimes, not in some places, but at all times and in all places. And I do think that the book and the Get the Facts Straight does basically make the point that Milton Friedman was making, and that is, and it's a point that I probably understand as well as anybody, having served for a quarter of a century in the belly of the beast. The marketplace protects the consumer. Government is heavily influenced by the special interest of the producer. And the problem is you got these people that have a lot of influence who are looking over the congressman's left shoulder, sending letters back home and text messages and telephone calls of whether he cares about the old, the poor, the sick, the bicycle rider, the sugar producer, whatever. Nobody is looking over his right shoulder saying, does he care about working people? Does he care about taxpayers? And so by its very nature, the political system is, unless you're very careful, and it's a line we crossed long ago, it ends up basically imposing special interest and extracting rents from hardworking, ordinary people who just want less government and more freedom. And you just see it over and over and over. And it's there in the facts.
Phil, I told Don this, you know, in the hallways in our department that, you know, a 19-year-old Pete reading this book would have went around and brought it to every class he went to and pushed it in the face of every student that came in my way. A 35-year-old Pete would have assigned it in every class that I teach principles of economics or whatever. The reason for that, I think, is precisely because of the way that you guys just laid this out, which is that this book is positive economics, straightforward. It's not normative economics. It's not tricky economics in terms of trying to infer intentions from outcomes.
No, that's right.
It's just means ends analysis. There's given ends, chosen means. How effective are those chosen means in obtaining those given ends? And that's economics at its best. To me, that's where, you know, all our incentive arguments and everything kick in. So you guys do a fantastic job in that. And you know, I can't praise you enough for that.
I should add here that thanks for that is mostly due to Phil. In the writing of it, I would often go off and fly some fancy, and Phil would very gently say, get rid of that part. you don't need.
I really appreciate what Phil said about steel manning the argument.
Yeah.
You know, because again, you know, we're hunting big game, which I'll get to in a second. And so in many ways, the world's on fire. And so we need the strongest possible scientific arguments, I think, to counter it as you know.
And our arguments are strong enough. You know, they're strong enough to knock down steel and dead arguments. We don't need to.
Well, and by not getting into name calling and impugning people's motives, I think it makes the book easier for somebody who doesn't necessarily agree with us to learn something from.
Yeah, no, on the other side, you have a lot of examples over the last decade of very successful books that have been focused on trying to, you know, attack the character of people on our side. You know, and falsely so, but they nevertheless they have some success in doing that. I was wondering, one of the things that struck me is Deirdre McCloskey. This might be too in the weeds, but Deirdre McCloskey has this wonderful paper in which she goes through and documents the 120 cases of market failure that students are taught, from principals to intermediate. So it's you know, this mythology of Econ 101. The problem is not that Econ 101 is taught too much. It's that it's taught too little, because right away we start talking about all the exceptions. You know, I just had my graduate class read a paper by George Akerlof on why the Keynesian revolution was so successful. And one of his arguments is that the one exception at a time gave research projects to graduate students for two generations, right? Because they just keep on finding, like, okay, here's the market. Oh, but there's an exception. And then they could write a paper on it, and they could write a paper on it. So he says it generated a whole scientific literature on that. I was wondering if you think that all of the kind of different cases of market failures in some sense collapse down to the seven mythologies, or are there more mythologies that are out there that need to be explored in book two and book three?
I think we focused on the seven, and I also think that in doing so, the book is almost an economic history of the United States. If a business school decided that maybe they should teach something about the history of American business, and if any part of a university ought to feel some obligation to understand capitalism, you'd think it'd be the business school. They could use our book to basically teach the economic history of the United States. And again, what we're trying to do in the book is to basically show that when you deviate from markets and create inefficiencies, that it affects real people and real progress. And when you get back to allowing freedom to work, the title of the book, The Triumph of Economic Freedom, prosperity reemerges.
On your specific question, P, obviously there are famous textbook externalities that are asserted about the real world that we don't touch in the book. And we don't talk anything about environmental regulation. We don't have a chapter on the economics of education. A lot of people believe that, you know, education is a public good, but I think every chapter that we chose does point to a major alleged externality. Well, you know, markets left to their own devices are going to become monopolized by these firms that simultaneously raise prices to screw consumers and lower prices to hurt their competitors. neat trick if you can do it. Markets are prone on their own to booms and busts. You know, the Great Depression was caused by a failure of the central bank, that it simply did not do the main job that it was established to do in 1913. And all of these, of course, are listed as externalities to this day in Econ 101 textbooks. And it's really a disservice to these students who are not sufficiently taught about the wonders of the market. How is it that billions of people, strangers from around the globe, daily cooperate with each other in a peaceful way that produces this abundance of goods and services that we all take for granted? And as you point out, too quickly the attention is drawn to alleged market failures. There's most of which are just failures in theory, because it's very difficult to actually find real world evidence for many of these so-called negative externalities.
Yeah, I think that the government as a corrective is you know, one of the main things that comes out of the progressive era, right?
Yeah.
And we keep on thinking about that as a solution. Phil, I just wanted to say something very quickly about your recommendation. When I first got out of graduate school, my very first job was in a MBA program. And I taught in this MBA program for 2 years. And I had to teach that they actually had an economic history class as part of the MBA. And I taught this, and I use Higgs's book. But if I was using it today, I would use your book to do the economic history in there, because it covers the whole gambit, you know, from the Industrial Revolution up to, you know, the current sort of debate. So I think it would be a fantastic thing to do it. And I think it's a better educational mission than the Harvard MBA pledge. I don't know if you're aware of it, but they passed this thing with the Harvard MBA pledge to say that we're not going to follow Milton Friedman's advice that, you know, the only goal is to maximize profits rather than, and instead we're going to produce social justice in our business kind of thing. And they all had to sign it. And every time I hear about it, I keep on thinking, how many of them like signed it and actually thought about it? They just were told, I have to sign this piece of paper. And, you know, they go from there. But I cut you off. I apologize, Phil. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I was just going to say that, you know, in the progressive era, the regulatory policy, the Sherman Act, it's so simple to show the massive failure of this approach. And by simply, what we do in the book is simply take the 20 years before the Sherman Act, when the, quote, abuse was occurring, and look at what happened to production and to price, and then compare it to the 20 years after the problem was fixed by the Sherman Act. And what you find is, in virtually every case, in every case of major industries that were regulated, production grew at a slower rate. Prices increased faster or fell slower after the regulation was in place than before it was put into place. So, and then 70 years later, when President Carter led the effort for deregulation, the evidence was overwhelming that the regulatory process was cheating working people. And so we deregulated these major industries and prices fell dramatically. Innovation exploded. In fact, the era we live in, with the explosion of the information mechanisms that we have, you can basically trace back to Jimmy Carter repealing progressive era regulation of the communications industry.
Speaking about that chapter on progressive era regulation, we relied heavily on that amazing stream of research that came out in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, empirical research on that was studying the effects of these interventions. And so, you know, so one, I think, inadequately appreciated benefit of the otherwise dark cloud of heavy government regulation is it does inspire really good economists to do research on them. And so we were, you know, we went back and reread all that stuff, the research done by people like, you know, Sam Peltzman and Tom DiLorenzo and Gary Leibkapp, and it's all very clear. And fortunately, Americans, I'm just saying something that's been implied here. Americans, Pete, you remember it too. You know, we were old enough to remember the 1970s. By the 1970s, Americans were feeling it. You know, inflation was noticeable. The economic growth had slowed. Unemployment was stubbornly high. And because good economists did good research, the moment was ripe for a courageous president, like as Carter was in the 1970s. It wasn't his party's natural disposition, but to pull back on those destructive interventions.
Don, I'm always, when you talk about the 70s, I'm always amazed when you think about Hayek's Nobel, because he starts right from the beginning. He says, look, we economists have nothing to be proud of. We've made a mess of things. Right? That's how he starts, rather than celebrating economics.
Which was 1974, yeah. But of course, he there was talking about inflation.
Yeah. I understand. But it has broader implications.
Yes.
I do think one of the things that I would really recommend to economics students that's in your book is that you do an amazing job of weaving facts with theoretical ideas, and then also theory, and theory informed or fact informed theory. So precisely what you were just talking about with the new learning in IO and the critique of antitrust against the structure conduct performance paradigm, right? Which it does it, or with Calamaris and fragile by design and the way, the way the banking industry is all screwed up and these kind of things. You do an amazing job of weaving back and forth between the facts of the matter, the theories that help us understand those facts, and then how those facts make us highlight certain new ways we go in theory. But one of the real puzzles, and this is just what you just were talking about, Don, is that we're also in a period of a great forget. So I'm going to ask about other movements going on, but just as intellectuals, we're in a period of a great forget. We're forgetting there's a rise of an interest in socialism. We're forgetting that socialism, you know, collapsed, right? So I was part of a Fraser project on, you know, realities of socialism to try to lay out the facts to young people about what the experience of socialism is like, because they have a wrong understanding of it. IO is a perfect example of this. We're back in a world of structure, conduct, performance.
Yeah.
Right. And yet we somehow defeated structure, conduct, performance. So I don't expect an answer, but this is kind of what I was thinking about with this persistence thing, because I'm not quite sure why it is that we go through these periods of forgetting what we've learned from the past in terms of these issues. And instead we always return to government as a corrective. Like we need a boss, right? Rather than rely on the market.
Let me take a shot at that. I think no bad idea ever dies. I used to, in the Senate, marvel that, my God, we would implement a policy that would fail, and then we turn around and we're debating the same policy again. But I think the birth-death cycle has something to do with this. Living memory is very important. You know, people that have lived under communism, they're cured. You have a very hard time convincing them that the state can be a source of righting all wrongs and promoting the general welfare. The problem with socialism is not a problem of the heart. It's a problem that it doesn't work, and that it creates misery and poverty and takes away freedom. So, you know, as we express it in the book, Marx thought that you could establish a system where government would take the place of a series of economic producers, from people that finance the system to people who innovate and invent, and that then government could wither away. But the problem is government doesn't wither away. Freedom and prosperity wither away, and they wither away quickly. So young people are attracted to the idea that, you know, we can solve problems through government. It seems you got a problem, you got a government, and it seems to make sense to let the government solve the problem. They generally don't know the government created the problem to begin with, which is often the case. And we're about to prove this all again in New York City.
Yep.
Yeah. We're down to our last few minutes, and I don't want to keep you guys too long. So I want to ask one last question and then have both of you respond to it, if you will, which is, it relates to what you just said, Phil, because we're living in a particularly strange times for economics, because we have a rise of the national conservatives on the right who are denying economic science. Don has been doing yeoman's labor trying to take on Orrin Cass and these, you know, people or whatever. But you have this rise going on. Our vice president is very influenced by these individuals as well. On the other hand, you have the Democratic Socialists, you know, which Mamdani is just one of. But I mean, we have several members of Congress and whatnot that are involved in that. And they're attacking economic science from the left. After writing this book and studying these issues in such depth and with such care, what do you think we economic educators, like this is from the authors to an educator, what do you think we need to be doing to counter both of these forces in our society at the moment? Because in many ways, in terms of economic discourse, the world's on fire. You know, we're and we need to really change that. And I was wondering what advice you might give to people who would like to join you in that battle.
You want to go first, Phil?
No, why don't you go? I just got to talk.
So I think doing what we do, what Phil and I do in the book is part of it. You look at history in a fair and honest way. You sort the data honestly, interpret them using sound economic theory, not complicated Econ 999, straightforward Econ 101. Good Econ 101. And people who are genuinely open-minded and genuinely interested in improving the world, who care, I don't think they can help but encounter those kinds of explanations without having their prior biases toward the use of government challenged. And so we economists, our jobs will never, this is what relates to what Phil said about no bad idea ever dies. Our jobs will never be over. We will constantly be called upon to remind people of the same eternal verities that Adam Smith reminded people of 250 years ago. That's 250 years from now, our successors are going to be saying the same, having the same kind of conversation that we're having now. But what choice do we have? We have to keep doing it. And as Bob Tollison said, you know this, Pete, because I think he said it to you too, as the late, great Bob Tollison said, we're all part of the equilibrium.
Yeah.
And so however bad the world might be, it would be worse if we weren't doing what we're doing. So we have to keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, I think the key is to point out when people have these new ideas of letting government fix our problems, is to point out past periods where we've tried that. And what did it produce? It's good to say we can change the world, but it's important to look. We're not the first people who ever had that idea. And these things have been tried over and over and over, and the results have been the same. Now, it's the picture's often confused because people don't have the facts. And that really was the point of the book. You know, why does Bernie Sanders think so differently than I do? He's intelligent. He's totally honest. I admire that about him. How can he view the world so differently than I do? And again, I think the point of the book is because he sees the world working in a very different way than I see it working. And so the real debate ought to be, he says it worked this way. He says it worked that way. What do the facts say? And that's what we try to do in the book. I'm no better intended than he is. It's just, you know, we've tried his way, our way, freedom, which you buy on the installment plan. You don't, you can't just one day do something great. When I left the Senate, the budget was balanced. The Soviet Union was destroyed. And we had strong economic growth and no inflation. And I at least was wise enough to say all these battles will be fought again. And they will be. No victory is final, but the good news flip side of that is no defeat's final either.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's just, you've written a fantastic book. I wish it the greatest of success and distribution. And thank you very much for coming on here and talking to me about it and contributing to this ongoing quest for a better world.
Thank you, Peter.
And thanks for what you, all the major contributions you make to our efforts at George Mason and to the larger economic education project. Thanks.
Sure thing, Don.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason, as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.